Hello, everyone. I'm sorry about the delay. I'm honored to be here. I'm Margot Hanley, and I'm a fourth-year PhD student at Cornell Tech in New York City, working with Helen Nissenbaum. And I'm excited to present some of my research today, Brain Business, Human Agency, and Autonomy in Commercial Brain-Computer Interfaces. So just this past month, some of you may have seen this study by researchers at UT Austin, received a lot of attention for what's being characterized as a major breakthrough in brain decoding. They showed that with a combination of fMRI scans, which measure blood flow to different areas of the brain, and large AI language models like ChatGPT, they could decode a person's continuous thoughts without the person uttering a single word. Now, this was in a clinical research context, and it's fMRI machines, so can't really exist in your Apple earbuds at the moment. But it does give us an idea of how rapidly this type of technology is advancing. And in fact, there are more and more for-profit private companies attempting to commercialize this technology and bring it into widespread use. So my research, as I'll talk about today, focuses on one, creating a rich and grounded account of what's happening in this rapidly evolving industry of commercial brain-computer interfaces, or BCI for short, in order to be able to provide a normative analysis of the values at stake with this technology. And I'll also note that I'm still pretty early on in this research, as some people have said today, so I'm presenting fairly initial observations from the field, and also that I'm in an interdisciplinary program and new to the surveillance community, so I'd appreciate recommendations for literature that I can use to think through this domain. I wonder if this thing works. Cool, so an agenda for the talk. So first I'm gonna take you through a quick primer on what brain-computer interfaces are and how they work. Then I'm gonna talk through research motivation and methods and some initial observations, like I said, from my interview study and ethnographic work. And then lastly, I'll quickly situate this work in my broader research agenda. And I should talk a bit more slowly, I think. But first things first, what is a brain-computer interface, some people might be thinking? Well, we're probably all familiar with the myriad examples in science fiction and cinematic portrayals, and who am I to say that these futures won't come to pass? Too risky. However, I would like to ground us in the commonly accepted definition of what a brain-computer interface system is today, what it's composed of, how it works, and the range of applications. So from a high level, a brain-computer interface is a technical system which serves as an intermediary between neural activity and external systems. BCIs often aim to assist, augment, or repair human cognitive or sensory motor functions. So here are some examples of BCIs. The bottom left image is of a paralyzed woman controlling a robotic arm through her thoughts. The man in the top right image has had a severe stroke and is unable to speak, so he's using a brain-computer interface to communicate his intended answers through his thoughts. And the bottom right image is two people using thoughts to control their moves in a game. Looks like tennis, table tennis, tennis. So in this field, BCI systems are typically described as four distinct stages, as illustrated in this schematic. The first is the mental event or intention, thought, feeling, et cetera, which is where the user generates some thought that they want to communicate to the external device through the BCI. In theory, this could be active or passive. Active mental thoughts are intentional, right? Those that you actively generate, such as moving a cursor on a screen or controlling a robotic arm. Passive mental thoughts or intentions are those that the user doesn't actively generate. They're triggered by the environment or the task, such as detecting the user's state of mind or emotional state. The second stage on the left is signal acquisition, which is how the system captures the neural data. So I include an image which illustrates the three types of ways BCIs can capture neural data invasively, where the device is implanted directly into the brain, requires surgery. Semi-invasively, where it's implanted beneath the skull. And non-invasively, which sits outside of the skull. The third stage is signal processing, which is a stage in which the BCIs interpret the neural data. This stage uses algorithms to extract and classify features, effectively translating the neural data into a command. And the fourth and last stage is the device, which is the external system that the BCI is connected to. And as I've mentioned, this could be a robotic arm or a computer cursor, for example, or a computer interface. So I'll begin by acknowledging that BCIs are not new. They've been around for decades, and here's an image of the first ever person who was in locked-in state, which means they were not able to speak, who was able to communicate his thoughts through BCI in 1999. What is new, however, is the amount of economic and commercial interest in BCI development. So here you see a bunch of newspaper headlines about these major investments in BCI. Familiar names like Elon Musk's Neuralink, Gates and Bezos have invested in Synchron's innovative technology. It uses a different technique, arguably maybe more effective, some people say. Peter Thiel, sadly, also in the mix here. And then one announced very recently, earlier this year, January 10th, of a BCI to treat depression. And this increasing commercial activity of BCIs and the prospect of their widespread adoption has generated concern, predictably, amongst experts and the general public. So here's a couple of headlines from major media outlets. Brain-computer interfaces could change the world, but at what cost? BCIs are moving from sci-fi to reality, for better or worse. Our notion of privacy will be useless. Do brain implants change your identity? And we're already beginning to see some of the costs of individuals of introducing these technologies from for-profit commercial companies as an early industry without strong regulation. So I found this particular example really chilling and heartbreaking when I read it a couple years back in The New Yorker. A woman named Rita Leggett had a BCI implanted to help manage her epilepsy. It worked, and she had it for 3 years until, quote, in 2013, her neurologist gave her some bad news. NeuroVista had run out of funding and ceased operations. Leggett's neural device would have to come out. When the journalist asked her about it, even years after the device was removed, she started to weep and said, I miss my device. And the limited regulation in this space only underscores the gravity of these issues. So brain-computer interfaces designed in a culture of rapid development without proper oversight, or in other words, BCIs in a world of move fast and break things. So while the literature on the social and ethical implications of commercial BCIs is limited, there are some scholars who have begun to examine these issues. So prior work has conducted broad surveys of the ethical and social implications of BCI and teased out particular values at stake for individuals, such as autonomy, agency, security, personal responsibility, and privacy. Scholars have completed some market research on BCI producers, such as the marketing language and use of algorithms in practice, as well as the users of commercial BCIs in various domains, such as gaming and autonomous vehicles. And lastly, there's been some effort to consider the policy environment of BCIs, like identifying the unique challenges of regulating BCIs and neurotechnology more broadly. My work adds to this existing literature in two significant ways, hopefully. First, it focuses on the very recent push to commercialize BCIs, so specifically the most cutting-edge and innovative technologies. This is a space with ever-evolving actors and techniques and investors and applications. And my second contribution is my taking a more holistic approach to this domain, in which I'm conducting research both to produce original empirical findings and ethical analysis at the same time. And for this first stage of the project, I was particularly interested in examining how BCI are poised to enhance and or threaten human autonomy. As such, my research questions are, first, what are the technologies, ideologies, and motivations driving the emergence of the commercial BCI industry? And second, what are the sources of variation in the development, deployment, and design of commercial BCIs that can inform the implications for human agency and autonomy? So the methodology. So I'm conducting first semi-structured interviews with the individuals involved in the production of the device. So far I've completed 14 interviews in my first round, but as I mentioned, I'm pretty early on and plan to continue interviews for quite a while. My criteria currently is pretty broad. So for this first round, I've interviewed members of management team. This could be founders, startup founders, or just C-suite executives. Technical employees like computational neuroscientists and product designers, as well as operations, and then investors in BCI. I'm also conducting a multi-sided ethnography, embedding myself in as many of these companies that will get me access, and of course attending industry events and trade-related events, and also founding a community in New York City which brings people in the neurotech and adjacent worlds together for happy hours. Very popular. And this is a way both to meet a lot of people who work in this area and possibly gain access to additional sites in which I could do the ethnographic work. and some initial findings, or observations, really, is what I'm calling them, because, again, it's more fitting for this stage of the work. So the first two observations are primarily descriptive and reflect trends that I'm learning about and seeing in the field, as well as hearing from the participants. And the first is that we're seeing a shift from primarily invasive to non-invasive technologies, and a proliferation of non-invasive technologies. The second is related, that there's a proliferation from non-medical applications, or from medical to non-medical. And the purpose of this descriptive work that I'm continuing to do is to inform this third piece, which is around locating values in the design and the development and deployment of these devices. And in particular for this study, or like first piece of the work, issues related to autonomy. So this first observation is that we're seeing a shift from invasive BCI to non-invasive BCI. So what's been interesting is hearing how the participants make sense of and justify the shift in the industry and their role in it. They've been describing it as one in which democratizes healthcare and gives consumers more choice. For example, in the case of medical applications, safer, less costly alternatives to the historically more invasive options. And here's, yeah, on the left is the invasive tech, and on the right is a bunch of models of the non-invasive technology. One illustrative quote here is a startup founder talking about how they're able to provide a better option for a patient to get the same quality and type of treatment for a medical condition through a non-invasive approach. He says, quote, "Nobody wants to get surgery ever. I mean, nobody wants to get something stuck in their body. Once it's implanted, what's implanted, you can't take it out even if you want to. It's going to stay on your nerve forever. You can't take it off, but, you know, now we can do it without surgery." Partially as a result of this recent proliferation of non-invasive BCIs and their capacities, the applications have expanded far beyond just medical treatments and are now being used in a variety of fields. Some have been mentioned today, such as digital health and wellness, robotics, communication technology, gaming, education, security, obviously military forever, domains in which invasive technologies would be far too costly and high risk for consumers. So here you see examples of BCIs for controlling drones, virtual reality headsets often used for gaming, and headphones which claim to be able to measure your focus level as you work. We're seeing BCIs, as was mentioned today by Kirsten, BCIs pop up in workplaces. So here's one of the most well-known examples, SmartCap, which is used in mining, trucking, construction, etc., and is marketed as a way to ensure both worker safety and public safety, great. And so, yeah, so here's preventing trucking fatigue accidents from driver's fatigue. Here are two examples of BCI being used in experiential marketing campaigns. So on the left is IKEA, which in 2017 launched a line of affordable rugs designed in collaboration with these famous artists. And they were in such high demand that they wanted to prevent users from just buying the items and selling them online at a markup. So they used EEG headsets to analyze customers' brain waves to determine if a customer loved the item sufficiently enough to buy it. Fun. On the right is a campaign started by L'Oreal in 2021, in which they use EEG headsets to analyze customers' emotions when smelling scents. Customers smell a series of perfumes and have a custom emotional neural map made about how their brain is responding to all these various scents. Many of the participants talk about how these types of non-medical applications are the ultimate end goal for most BCI firms, even ones developing invasive BCI. So this startup founder says, quote, you know, take whatever big name BCI company you can think of. If you notice, like, the way that they market it to the external world is like, we're going to help paraplegics. And that's why we're building this technology. And that sounds amazing. But when people are showing things to investors, they're like, we're gonna have this thing, it's gonna integrate with a phone, that it's gonna read your brain, it's gonna let you do thought to text and thought to image and thought to video, like interface with your brain so we can communicate with these crazy bandwidths, and we're gonna completely eliminate the cell phone. So you see here in public, the companies are marketing their devices as invasive devices used for persons with disabilities or, you know, paraplegics or, you know, veterans that have prosthetic limbs to kind of get, you know, the goodwill of us all. And then behind closed doors, they're telling investors that these will be general purpose tools, non-invasive soon, eventually, and we'll be able to replace mouses, keyboards, smartphones, and just life as we know it. So when people think about threats to autonomy in BCI, they tend to think about bodily integrity, mind reading, or your thoughts being read against your will, or mind control, thoughts implanted into your brain without your awareness or consent. But in current commercialization of BCIs, autonomy is popping up and coming up in quite a number of different ways. And I've picked a few key examples to illustrate. So here's a quote from a CMO, chief marketing officer, at a non-invasive BCI startup, describing how their application can be autonomy enhancing, providing people more information about themselves in a similar vein as a lot of quantified self community. So he says, giving them like a little green, red, yellow, green light on their headset, the physical data state of when you perform your best, is very helpful for them to sort of imprint like, oh, this is me, my peak performance. And non-invasive sensors are just easier for people to, you know, tolerate in everyday settings. Other participants discussed designing the devices to intentionally limit users' autonomy to protect them from themselves, keep them safe. It's a bit paternalistic. But in this case, you know, it's a medical device. So this is the founder of a company which makes a device which acts as a neuromodulator to treat sleep apnea. He says, I don't want them to know anything else is happening. I'm debating whether I even let the users change their settings on their device, right? Because I'm kind of trying to take a Steve Jobs approach to medical device design. Both of these examples of many are presented by this participant as seemingly positive, right? It's their view, obviously. So, and in the first case, providing reports to people about things that they find difficult to monitor themselves, right? So information they might not otherwise have. And in the second case, protecting people's physical safety with this black box, pretty opaque interface. But there's also kind of dystopian version of both of these examples, as is probably apparent to everyone here. Imagine the former headset being deployed in the workplace, a tool of control by employers who not only see how focused you are, but might get a real-time stream of your data, or may change your compensation based on how focused you are. Or in the second case, consider how this device design approach could deprive people from any understanding, let alone control or sense of agency over how the device works or what they're doing or what the device is doing. So these examples and normative implications from the interviews already begin to map in pretty apparent ways onto common conceptions of autonomy. So the device which provides information to a user about their productivity or focus might have an enhancing capacity to allow people to articulate and grapple with their ideas, goals, and desires, for example, but deployed in a workplace environment might diminish one's ability to act in self-determination, transforming them instead into instruments of social control. The device which modulates to treat sleep apnea may enhance one's self-determination or freedom and opportunity to make choices of practical import to one's life, reducing obstacles and increasing their horizons of choices. But in the device's opaqueness might challenge the authenticity condition, for example, or one's sense of understanding whether their actions or choices are even their own. So clearly the details matter tremendously to an assessment of autonomy in these devices and other ethical values, both descriptively and normatively. So the domain, is this, for example, for the workplace or for individual personal use? The application, is it for medical or for gaming or for driving? I mean, you know, the list goes on. The design, is it transparent to the user or not? Again, should it be? Maybe not, maybe. The company's business model, of course, should also be considered. So we'll be giving our brain data to use Facebook. You know, imagine that. So in conclusion, right on time, I think, there are many companies which are already attempting to make this technology mainstream far before there's, you know, kind of careful and thoughtful reflection about the societal implications, let alone legal and regulatory frameworks in place, especially in the States. And the ethical stakes, as I've hopefully demonstrated, are extremely high. And just to emphasize that it's critical that we get a grounded understanding of how this industry is evolving and the commercialization practices around these devices. As I showed in the examples, while we don't see concerns of complete mind control yet, we're already seeing concrete normative implications surface, showing how critical it is that we do this very nitty-gritty qualitative work in order to be attuned to the details of these systems and their deployment. And in time, I hope that this research can contribute to this small but growing effort to develop legal and regulatory frameworks in this domain. And thank you.